Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 42, section 3, which is old single column, page 471. All right, so recall last session, we went through that great big template section where they laid out the foundational elements of the spectrum, if you will, of energy from the absolute nature of space potency on one end to the absolute nature of the substance of the Isle of Paradise on the other end. And we began to get the feeling for how you can more literally think about the universe as a universe of motion instead of it being a universe of matter fundamentally. Yes, there is matter, as you see tonight. We have a section is entitled Classification of Matter. And they're going to generalize that word matter in the process of giving us that section. But you have a spectrum of physical energy, more fundamentally, and that energy is a motion in every way, shape, and form. 100%, it's all motion. The only fact that's motionless is the substance of the isle. And we developed that beginning recognition of how we're coming down from the absolute to the co-absolute, having that super-additive consequence in the co-absolute. And then as we're going top-down, super-additive means we're going from co-absolute down to absonite. And we got our first absonite expression of a motion that manifests in the finite and in some basic foundational ways, that the force charge of space, that fundamental outward motion that upon which everything is founded. And now they're going to begin to build upon that. And before we start to get into the details of, what's playing out upon that primordial force stage, that force charge of space stage, let's just go back and look at one of the statements that they made towards the end of the previous section. The next to last paragraph of section 2, let me just read that statement that they made. Remember how they, after they gave us the spectrum, they were giving us some final sort of big picture reflections to hold on to. Okay, and they were reminding us again of how important the power beings are in all physical processes across that whole spectrum of energy. And they said the following: these power directors themselves are energy catalyzers. Remember how they mentioned that to think of them as not being some sort of a reservoir out of which stuff is being actualized in any way. They're just a catalytic agency that's fostering this actualization through that spectrum of energy. And then they said, that is, they cause energy to segment, organize, or assemble in unit formation by their presence. And all this implies that there must be something inherent in energy which causes it thus to function in the presence of these power entities. And I didn't want to try to unpack all of that towards the end of last time, because it makes a great intro to hear, and we can flesh it out a little bit more. Okay, so the first thing that catches your eye, if you're trying to remember what you've learned reading paper 42 countless times, and you see unit formation, are they talking about automatons? You know, is that what they mean by some sort of a a fundamental unit? Yes, in part. That is certainly one of the units, and when we get into the next section here, that's the starting point, is to look at what's directly tied to that kind of unit, that unit of direct individuation of a finite localized phenomenon, you know, something that's going to have a spherical footprint in the finite, centered about the centering influence of the aisle, you know, so that it literally has a spatial a localization to it. You know, it's within this radius and not outside of it. So yes, that's part of it, but it's more fundamental than that. Every aspect of what goes on with the physical phenomena is quantized, is done in unit formation, not just the little sort of things that you're building stuff out of, but how those things interact and what those things do, all of that is in unit formation. So that when you remember how we've referred to getting up to that full electronic level particle of 100 ultimatons in a system, and then you begin to have electronic level energy augmenting that electronic level base, that foundation. Now, that electronic level energy is not added, you know, doesn't augment that foundation in any sort of a continuous fashion, you know, where you can have any fraction of the phenomenon. It's integer-wise. You can have one unit or two units or three units, etc. Okay, and nothing in between. So in complete generality, the whole energy-matter phenomenon is in unit formation like that. And this is very important to keep that in mind. And as you reflect on it, it's like, well, I mean, if I see a manifestation that's so definitively discrete like that, it all the more doesn't smack of some sort of a random process. You know, as we reflect on something that's going to be random, it's like, well, you know, why not 1.328 units? If it's, you know, it's just something that has no purposing behind it, it ought to just be every shade of gray. But if I see 1, 2, 3, very precisely, like, wow, is that a coincidence? Well, you can say, well, I think it's just inherent in matter that it has that nature. It could have had a non-integral nature, but that sort of a universe wouldn't have worked, and so that's why that sort of universe doesn't exist. So it's just a fact that we live in a universe that exists and can observe this, that it's going to coincidentally have the requirements for a stable universe. And that's basically what scientists do today, and that's also what Lucifer, put forward in his first principle, that first principle of the Lucifer Manifesto, that that sort of foundational order is just inherent, and there is no purposing behind it. Remember that first principle is the nihilistic principle, the rejection of fundamental purposing, to reality. Okay, and when they say after that, and all this implies that there must be something inherent in energy which causes it thus to function. What is that? What that is energy pattern. I mean, how else, what's the simplest way that you might just, without any understanding of the use of the word pattern in the fifth epical revelation, but you're just observing this, it's like, well, there's kind of a pattern to the way this works, the way it's like 1 and 2 and 3, and it seems to be patterned. It is. And the reason they say it that way, you know, there must be something inherent in energy. Unlike with spirit substance, just the mere actuality of spirit substance, and then its purposing with spirit pattern, personality, those two facts are very manifestly distinct. You know, even to finite beings, they can see spirit substance that's not patterned, that's not purposed, and then they can see purpose engaging that spirit substance, and now it's purposed, it's patterned. The patterning, the energy pattern, you know, or as the revelators usually just say pattern for short, you know, because they're going to use personality for spirit pattern, so that you have pattern and personality is the two words. That energy pattern is very innate with the actuality. You know, so that the reality and the actuality are much more tightly linked when you're talking about energy than when you're talking about spirit. Okay? And that, you know, so you don't see sort of amorphous energy and then there's a definitive pattern that obviously gets imposed and now it starts to manifest in unit formation or something like that. It's all just there and seems to like magically just crystallize, you know, in the process, that it's patterned as it actualizes. It's not, you know, it's a conjoint manifestation. Okay, so that's what's going on. So that, you know, you're recognizing that this catalytic presence of these power beings is much more than just you know, a relationship to the actuality of the phenomenon. The fact that the pattern just crystallizes in their presence means they have to be coordinated with this as well. And that's why, you know, they mentioned the infinities of divinity there, like as I pointed out last time, that you fundamentally are reminded that in the source for pattern, there is no distinction between spirit pattern and energy pattern. It's just pattern. The Father is prior to the differentiation between spirit and energy. You know, purposing is purposing. You know, there's not two purposings, and you're going to expect most of the time it's going to be schizophrenic, and every once in a while, coincidentally, they're going to synchronize. No, they're inherently one purposing. And at the highest level, lowercase I infinity not only means the divinity of capital I infinity, the divinity of capital I infinity, the divinity of the functioning of deity on the infinite level, you know, it also equally means the totality of reality, the totality of thingness. so that, and I want to really stress that, because if you don't recognize that everything that you have to interpret when you try to get into the physics is fundamentally unit-wise, you won't be able to get started on a proper footing in developing a physics, if you're going to actually do that, or even beginning to recognize just basically philosophically what they're trying to tell you. You know, if they say there's an axial revolution, okay, that's not, well, I could have an axial velocity, you know, at any, you know, number of decimal places. No, it's one unit, two units, or, you know, there is nothing that's, you know, and so thinking about something rotating on an axis where it can, you know, it can rotate at speed one or speed two, but no speeds in between. It's like, well, how does it get from speed one to speed two then if it can't go through the speeds in between? Right? Those sorts of things you've got to recognize, and it's fundamentally quantized like that. All right. So now, as I mentioned there, the classification of matter, back in the first section, I think it was, remember how I mentioned it in passing, they were alluding to, reminding yourself that you can basically think of two conservation principles. I mean, you have conservation of energy, where energy is generalized to, you know, beyond what we currently think of energy, energy in general, and you have a conservation of that. But you have a specific, where you have conservation of automatons. You have conservation of the little thinglets, you know, the smallest things, these, you know, direct individuations, you know, even literally, you know, definitively spatially delimited. So that, you know, keeping, you know, even though an automaton, yeah, is a, you know, is a unit of energy, and you could think of it in general as being part of the conservation of energy, that you have conservation of automatons. But it's the parallel to what we used to have when we thought of mass as being eternal. And so we had two conservation. We had the eternity of mass and the conservation of energy. You still have that to a degree. You have you have an eternity of, you know, relative to finite processes. You have an eternity of these definitive individuations. You know, and you can keep a tally of that on the one hand. And then on top of that, the whole energetic interplay, that equation always balances as well. Okay, and so they're now going to get into that, you know, these individuations more specifically. And we're going to generalize the word matter in this title. They don't always. Sometimes they use the word matter in a more specific way to really refer to, once you get to universe power, you know, like especially full-blown atoms, you know, then they'll say you have matter, and prior to that you had energy. Of course, that matter actually is energy too. Here, we're going to use the word matter in a more generalized way rather than that specific way to just indicate the particleness phenomenon, separate from the energetic issue. All right, so let's get into this and see what they have to say to us here.
Section 3, classification of matter. Matter in all universes, excepting in the central universe, is identical. Matter in its physical properties depends on the revolutionary rates of its component members, the number and size of the revolving members, their distance from the nuclear body, or the space content of matter, as well as on the presence of certain forces as yet undiscovered on Urantia.
All right, two things. Just the opening statement, stressing that again. We've mentioned that already, but just remind yourself that outside of the central universe, doesn't matter if you're, you know, at the heart of some very, very micromanaged, deeply settled, enlightened life location in the super universe level, or you're way out where nothing has even gotten started yet in the fourth outer space level, it's all the same physical energy phenomenon. There's no differential. All the outer space levels, the super universe level, all of the extra central universe domain has that fundamental dual manifestation of energy in contrast to the triune in the central universe. And then, of course, the singular for the aisle. All right, and then, you know, if you, if all you have is some beginnings of physics from evolutionary science, and you read that first paragraph, you go, okay, it seems like they're referring to what the basic idea of atoms. Now, and perhaps a little bit in an antiquated fashion, where it seems to be talking about it like it was a little solar system. I think, well, I guess that's to be expected. I mean, it was written way back in the beginning of the 20th century. Okay, but as you look a little bit more closely, there's things that are kind of non sequitur to, you know, dismissing it like that. So, you know, matter in its physical properties depends on the revolutionary rates of its component members. So you're thinking, well, I guess I'm thinking like the planetary-like orbits of electrons, you know, around a nucleus. But then it says the number and size of the revolving members. are electrons different sizes? Yeah, they certainly are different numbers around an atom, but maybe my initial assumption is not valid here. Maybe they're not speaking so simplistically. One of the things that is being encompassed by these words is the phenomenon that it is an atom with its nucleus and a system of electrons. But they're not just focusing on that. In general, for instance, you know, an electronic level particle, that, you know, let's just forget about all the augmentation, just to take the base, the collection, you know, the system, that collection of 100 ultimatons. Okay, that's also being referred to here. Okay, just because they say revolutionary rates doesn't mean that it's implying orbital revolutionary rates. It could be axial revolutionary rates. Right? You notice they didn't, you know, qualify because they wanted it general. Right, so it doesn't matter if you're talking about the axial revolutionary rates or orbital revolutionary rates. They can vary. The axial revolutionary rates of the ultimatons in that system of 100 can be all kinds of different magnitudes. Okay. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, etc. Okay. All right. So, you know, that's definitely not outdated 20th century science. You know, size, like it could be an ultimaton or it could be an electron. They're a lot different in size. Many, many orders of magnitude different in radius. All right. And then they say their distance from the nuclear body, you know, that made you really start to think you were just thinking about a simple solar system like an atom. You know, but then they say, or the space content of matter. And you're going, well, why did they qualify it if they're just talking about how far away this planet-like electron is from the nucleus? Again, remember that everything is a motion. And that motion is constructed via the fact of space as a literal stuff. And we were talking about that last time. Space is a co-absolute fact. It's a co-absolute thing. It's a co-absolute stuff that, you know, is ubiquitous. And when you took that co-absolute modified presence of space potency, juxtapose it with the co-absoluteness of space, and, you know, so now they had a relationship because they were both co-absolute, and you got that super additive consequence of that absonite motion. See, that absonite motion, space is involved, you know, rolled into that motion. Space is always involved in motions. Space is an element of the motion that isn't an ultimaton.
As opposed to being neutral, as opposed to just being
right, as opposed to space not being something literal that could be involved in anything, and just extension space. No, it's a stuff. I mean, you know, in a sense, what the revelation is saying, yeah, you have infinite extension space, but in a finite domain, that extension space is pervaded by stuff space. Okay. Right? Thing space. Yeah. Not infinite, co-absolute. Okay, so when they say the space content and matter, you know, if you're talking about the system of ultimatons, that collection of 100 ultimatons, you know, there's space as an element of each one of those ultimatons. You know, and, you know, we don't know exactly how to think about the system yet, but you probably don't want to think of it in any way where there's really space in between the ultimatons. You know, you really want to just think, finally, you have a system of 100 ultimatons, and now you have this electronic level particle, you know, and space is involved in it. Part, you know, it's now a motion, you know, constructed motion, you know, a net motion, you know, and there's a certain measure of space involved in that motion that is that particle, you know, so there's space in it. That particle occupies space. In the Revelation, when they say occupy space, they mean the space is literally involved in it. Now with an atom, okay, you've got one of those particles in the center, the nucleus, so there's occupying space there. There's each of the electronic level particles, the electrons. Each one of those occupies some space. But then there's actually space between the particles as well. Okay? And you have a net spherical phenomenon that is the atom. Okay, and within that sphere, there's these particles that occupy space. And then there's also within that sphere contains space. And that space between the particles. Okay. So when they're saying the space content of matter, it's of two elements. An amount of space that's contained within that spherical phenomenon and an amount of space that's occupied by that spherical phenomenon. All right, see, so that's, you know, when they just say their distance from the nuclear body, that's just the contains space part. And it's what you maybe initially can have some handle on. You know, it's the initial on-ramp. You're reading this, and if you haven't figured out the universe of motion stuff and all these, you know, you at least say, well, they seem to be talking about atoms, and okay, I think I know a little bit about that. It gives you some way to start doing something with what you're reading. But, you know, to go beyond the surface, you know, you immediately come into conflict with everything that you hold dear in your physics, you know, and have to rethink.
I have a question.
Yep.
We were just saying something about don't think about the automaton as occupying space.
No, it occupies space. The automaton occupies space. No, it doesn't contain space because it's, you know, it's the smallest individuation. So there's no way there can be any in between. You know, there's no two things to be in for in between this to exist. Right? It's just this singular fact. So all it could possibly do is occupy space. Yeah, it's and the way you can start to, you know, abstractly imagine or appreciate space being involved in this phenomenon. It's a unit of motion. You know, I've said this several times. What's the simplest handle you have on the idea of a motion? Well, when I talk about motions, I talk about the speed of those motions. I talk about some distance, you know, relative to some interval of time. You know, like miles per hour. So, like miles is like, okay, that's like space, and hour, that's like time. So you have sort of space and time in a reciprocal relationship to give you motion. You know, remember the relators say, you know, space is the chronicity of motion. Right? So you have, oh, did I say space?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, time. Time is the chronicity. Thanks you for keeping tabs on me like that. Time is the chronicity of motion. The reason I said space is because I was thinking ahead of what I was going to say next. Sorry about that. I do that all the time. Right, so time is the chronicity of motion. So you have this space that's involved in it. You have this phenomenon that's called motion set up, utilizing space, you know, uses space sort of more substantively in it. And then there's a chronicity to that phenomenon, which you abstract as what we call time. You know, but fundamentally, you have space and motion, not space and time. You know, and we, like we said, we saw that we had space, pre-existent, and then we set up motion, you know, in that space. All right. Please, you know, try to notice if I say something that sounds illogical and catch me.
And here's the last part.
All right. So, See, so they are actually giving you a very generalized statement. Like I said, you want to think of matter here in a very generalized way. Don't just think of it as atoms in the specific sense of matter, you know, full-on power, full-on purposed energy. And then they say, as well as on the presence of certain forces as yet undiscovered on Urantia. Okay, as I mentioned, I think it was last time, or just recently anyway, most of the time when they refer to the undiscovered fact or the, you know, or not yet recognized or unknown or whatever word they use, fact, relative to physical energy, it's the sub-electronic phenomenon that they're referring to. Okay, here, if you take that atom, that space that sphere that is the atom contains isn't a vacuum. We know one thing already from what we've just, you know, read in the previous section. That space that atom contains is pervaded by the force charge. Every nook and cranny is pervaded by the force charge, okay, including within the sphere of that atom. And those particles are coupled to the force charge. So when they, you know, if you think of them as like an electron being in an orbit, it's not moving through a vacuum, you know, it's moving through that pervaded space, and it's coupled to that, you're going to have waves in the force charge. There's this whole system of motion within that sphere, in between the particles, that they're referring to here. The basic way that atoms are held together and that molecules are held together, the basic way that everything is assembled into systems of greater and greater complexity built upon automatons is through this medium, this dynamic medium that's between things. And those waves, for instance, you know, the simple way to appreciate how there might be a means for the electrons to be coupled to the nucleus via this, the waves that you set up in that force charge, this set of standing waves, have the same amount of momentum, the same amount of oomph, basically, as the electrons themselves. Okay, and so, you know, if you can imagine poking a bump in the force charge and poking an electron, you know, they both feel the same, you know, have the same amount of resistance to them, the same amount of presence to them, the same amount of dynamic consequence to them, right? So, you know, if that's the case, just thinking about it conceptually, it's like, well, where is the electron, you know, and where is the stuff between? If it's all kind of the same lumpiness, the same kind of thickness, the same kind of dynamic magnitude. All right, see, just, you know, it's like the nucleus gets extended out, you know, and so now just having, instead of having a nuclear sphere, you have a whole atomic sphere. It's like we talked about in 41, same idea. Remember when we were talking about stars and they kept referring to that you have this very coupled system that has a surface with a star, and then you have an atmosphere above that where it's more billiard ball-like independent particles related to that nuclear.
It's like a charge.
Right, and so... You know, think about one of the fundamental aspects of properties of that electron is its charge. Okay, that charge is a unit of motion that augments that electronic level base. Okay, and that electronic level energy, see, is coupled into this whole undiscovered system. I mean, you can think of that charge, that kind of motion, as being blurred through the region. See, and not just so glued to the billiard ball like scientists currently think it is. You know, it's something that you can add and subtract from that billiard ball, that collection of 100 automatons, and it's something that's coupled into the non-billiard ball-like force charge in between, You know, and so you can kind of think of that electronic level energy as playing within that system. You know, sort of feeling an affinity for being near a particle, but not just glued to it, but more, you know, within the whole region. And this is why the current, you know, scientific ideas of orbitals, you know, works to a degree. There aren't literally orbitals like they think, these magical quantum mechanical things that they construct. But they need to construct something that is blurred. Okay? It's not an orb, it's not a particle in an orbit, it's an orbital. It's orbit-like, you know, these constructs that they've made. See, it's a way of rationalizing the system when you don't know about the force charge, you don't know about the system of motion, you don't know the specifics. You can rationalize, get the correct answer by using this artifice, you know, that is quantum mechanics and all of the elements of it. Okay? It's a way of of bridging your ignorance. Okay? Between you know, the ignorance is between your false initial assumptions and the actual observed facts. Okay? And getting that, you know, if you didn't have at least two falsehoods, you couldn't get the correct answer. You know, you have to always have a pair of falsehoods in order to get the correct answer. And so you have the false assumptions about what the foundational facts are, and then you have a complementary false assumption about what those things do, and then the two together get you the correct answer.
Is there a pattern to this design that's more
Well, you know, like I said, I just, you know, one of the biggest macro example of it is what they pointed out in the previous paper. Like I said, I mean, a star is literally like this, you know, where there's this very tightly coupled energy system, you know, that has a surface, you know, in a non-arbitrary way. And then there's the not so tightly coupled energy phenomena outside of that, okay? You know, and you just have various shades of this. I mean, you know, the nucleus is very obviously a very tightly coupled system. You know, and then later in this paper, they'll remind you that the innermost electrons almost like blur into the nucleus. You know, but by the time you get to the outermost electrons, then they're much more like a billiard ball. You know, and so there's like a spherical domain with a surface, and then a few valence, you know, or chemically active electrons orbiting outside of that. See, anything like that. See, we're to, and this is all of what I'm saying here. If you follow this, you know, what it allows you to do is to fundamentally rework how you understand. The bonding mechanisms in molecules, and you know, right now you have this billiard ball model with lots of hand wavy rationalizations to glue it together. You know, and you don't have the fundamental fluidity, if you will, of the system of motion. You know that it actually is to make this phenomenon. More objectively, more directly in a description of the objective fact of what's going on. All right. They're going to expand upon the forces as yet undiscovered. You know, in a later section, when we actually start to get into some of the mechanics of the atom. But your first clue is just, you know, this is in the wake of introducing you to force, energy, power, and talking about primordial force. When they say certain forces, okay, you're going, I bet you they don't just mean in a really fuzzy sense, do they? You know, I bet they mean, in a more literal way. That, like I said, you have the force charge of space, right? And you have waves in that force charge, see? And so it's that modified force charge that is the certain forces.
Gravity not being one of the forces.
Well, I see, and again, you know, we have to, you know, we use the word force, like electric force or gravitational force, and the Revelators, you know, never mean that when they say force. You know, there is no Newtonian gravitational force. Everything's a motion. Gravity is a motion. And you'll see they talk about gravity in the context of matter. You know, the fundamental atomic structure of matter, you know, which in a Newtonian sense, that's completely nonsensical. Right, and that would be an easy way for someone who can't get out of the old modes of thinking to just dismiss what is being said, you know, being said here. When they, you know, they see that and it's like, well, whoever wrote this, I mean, doesn't even understand that gravity is trivially too small a force to have anything to do with holding an atom together, right? You know, and yet they say that. It's like, well, you know, either you think that whoever wrote it is stupid, or you know, maybe they're trying to challenge me to think about this stuff in a new way. Maybe I'm ignorant and need to challenge myself to expand my cosmic horizons. Okay. All right. So, wow, one tiny little paragraph there, and we've already got 45 minutes under our belt.
I think you did very well.
This is normal.
Okay. All right. So now let's look at some of the... They're going to give you some bullet points, a little thumbnail sketch of another sort of spectrum of things. All right. Let's see what they say here.
In the varied suns, planets, and space bodies, there are 10 grand divisions of matter. 1. Ultimatonic matter, the prime physical units of material existence, the energy particles which go to make up electrons.
Okay. All right. We probably want to do each bullet point, you know, and one at a time. But, you know, just the way it starts out, 10 grand divisions, you know, before you actually, you know, look and see that there's, you know, the numbers 1 through 10, you're going 10 grand divisions. Do they mean here those 10 fundamental forms of physical energy that they talk about, for instance, when they talk about the power beings and how they can handle 7 of the 10? And is that the 10 they're referring to? Are these the 10 fundamental forms? You know, well, as you start to scan it, you know, you quickly recognize, no, that's not going to be an initial assumption that's going to work here. But you also know, okay, it can't just be a coincidence that it's 10. There must be some parallel between those 10 fundamental forms and this list of 10 they've constructed. So there's a potential for some very interesting high-level reflection about what that parallel, you know, analogy is. You know, in what way does this kind of synchronize with that sequence of 10 forms? You know, where you know you have 7 dead energies and 3 living energies in that set of 10, and all those issues, and you know, how does that maybe match up with this? Okay, so we're obviously not going to be able to flesh that out, but see, that's a very fun little tidbit that is kind of a hanging way out ahead of you somewhere in the future for some discoverer to figure out exactly how you synchronize those. All right, ultimatonic matter. Like I said, so they're not going to be thinking in the more generalized energy sense, but we want to think about in the more individuated particle-like sense. And you see they call them the energy particles, right? See, which go to make up electrons. Now, you've heard me say, you know, most of the time you want to use the word particle for electronic level collections of 100. You know, that's a particle in the way we always use the word particles. But, you know, But obviously the energy is particulated here. You know, the ultimaton is just right here at my fingertip and not over there or something, right? It's definitely localized in space, individuated in that sense. And they're the prime physical units, of material existence in that sense. And you can call them ultimatonic matter, even though they don't have any mass or charge or anything like you think of electronic level particles as having in terms of their electronic level energy phenomenon. In the generalized sense of matter, in the generalized sense of individuation, it's ultimatonic matter. All right, so later on we'll get more into the waves and the force charge and things like that. But here we're just focused on that part. Okay, then they bring in number two.
Two, subelectronic matter, the explosive and repellent stage of the solar supergases.
Okay, several things there. We saw them use that expression, supergases, back in the previous paper, and I mentioned that they were going to come back to that. They don't just mean what we think of a gas being in some sort of a extreme state, and so it's a super gas, right? No, it's much more fundamentally a very transcendent phenomenon, in the sense of. Of super being above, transcendent. And at the same time that it's transcendent, it's sub-electronic. All right, so if the transcendence is if you transcend the electronic level to the, and go sub-electronic, you have this super gas phenomenon. So in the interior of the star, where things are being unraveled, remember, they're reminding you that, it can be ultimately unraveled all the way into ultimatons, but there's a whole, as we've mentioned, there's a whole range of phenomena in between collections of 100 and single ultimatons. There's that whole sub-electronic energy domain, and it's not just some sort of amorphous-like energy waves or whatnot in that sub-electronic domain. There's a particleness going on there as well. Okay, and that's what's being referenced here, is the particleness of that sub-electronic domain. Initially, it's like when they were mentioning the undiscovered forces. You're thinking, well, that's probably more like waves and the force charge, things like that. But how does this work, actually? I mean, who knows? How is this whole complex system we know nothing of waves and augmentations and particles and, this whole complex phenomenon in that sub-electronic domain, how does that all interplay within and relative to an atom? Right, there's just endless questions here, okay? But within that star, where you have the gravity, putting a lid on this whole phenomenon, keeping it all clamped down and it's very tightly coupled, even though it has no, these sub-electronic things don't have anything like mass or charge that would, that they would feel a, some sort of a grip on them in that sense, that's keeping them, within the star. Like when we're talking about the calcium atom, it's got a mass, it's got to gravitationally escape from that star in a simple Newtonian-like sense even, right? But what if you have something that doesn't have any mass or anything and doesn't, really even have the beginnings, hardly, of linear gravity phenomenon or electric charge-like phenomena? It's obviously going to want to, in and of its own accord, just go flying off at the speed of light in every direction. Okay, a very repellent manifestation, okay, or even potentially obviously explosive, if there's some sort of lid that's put on something and then that lid is ruptured, You know, it's not exploding, but it's explosive. It has definitely has a tendency towards exploding potential because of its very fundamental outwardness. Okay? Okay, so that's what they're getting at there. Yep.
So you mentioned a few minutes ago that the, you know, sub-electronic matter was also, you know, in the micro stages, I think, not just in the star, but also, you know, at the, what we consider the, you know, is in the space, so to speak, of whether it's an atom or whether it's a, you know, molecule,
right,
whatever. Is this the same sub-electronic matter they're talking about? Or
well, again, I tried to, you know, tried to stress that. Notice this is sub-electronic matter, so they're just talking about individuations of a sub-electronic nature. There's also non-individuated phenomena of a sub-electronic nature. So there's, you know, the simplest way is there's particles and waves. There's particles and waves of a sub-electronic nature.
Waves are not matter.
In the way they're saying it here, no. Right? The waves are waves in the force charge. You know, and the force charge is a continuum. There isn't a wave is a non-localized phenomenon. Right, and yeah, there has to be a medium. Right, see, and it's an extended phenomenon. Okay, see, so, but it's, whether it's a wave or it's a particle, it's small. It's smaller than electronic level size things and bigger than ultimatons. You have one of these spheres of sub-electronic matter, it's going to be bigger than an ultimaton and smaller than a collection of 100 ultimatons.
And it's not charged.
And it's not charged. It doesn't have mass.
It's basically not hard to measure.
Right. It's complete. That's why it's undiscovered, because there's nothing we have, you know, that could measure it. Right. And it's philosophically undiscovered because we aren't demanding a logical atom, just a mathematical system that gets us correct answers. Right? Okay, so that's why they're saying, see, that's why they're saying explosive and repellent, because at this stage still, there's nothing, remember, it's all started with the force charge, which was fundamentally an outward motion, okay? And we're moving towards having something that's inward, you know, to some degree. And we haven't gotten there yet in any significant way.
So
it's still... as we're going 1, 2, 3, as we're going down this list, as we're stepping through this, they're still describing where we're at stage two here as something that's fundamentally outward. And if you plop them in front of you, if there's nothing containing them, they're just going to go flying away. You know, we know even when you get to the electronic level, the beginnings of the electronic level stage, and you have that collection of 100 ultimatons, or even... a thing you call a photon particle, you know, which doesn't have any direct mass or electric charge. You know, if you just plop it in front of you, what does it do? It goes flying off at the speed of light still. It's just like a marker dot on the force charge still. It still just manifests that outwardness of the force charge. It doesn't manifest any inwardness relative to that. You know, for something to just stay put right in front of me, it's got to be doing as much inward as the force charge wants it to do outward. See? If it's going to stay put there in front of me, it has to be completely counteracting that force charge wanting to make those marker dots just fly away in every direction at the speed of light. Yeah. So, you know, think about how dynamic the phenomenon of the chair or the couch you're sitting on is for it to be staying put like that. You know, if it obeyed the force charge, it would fly in every direction at the speed of light. But it's staying nice and cushy underneath you. Right? And your body and everything. Right? See, it's a vast dynamic thing where you have outward and inward balanced. All right. Okay, so that's what they're getting at there. And then number three.
Three, electronic matter. The electrical stage of material differentiation, electrons, protons, and various other units entering into the varied constitution of the electronic groups.
Okay, you see how, you know, saying the varied constitution of the electronic groups. Remember how, I've tried to point this out. I mean, you have to look at the context. When they say electron, do they literally mean the thing that we call electron, that kind of electronic level particle? Or do they mean one of those electronic level-like facts?
Well,
it's both. I mean, it depends on the context. You know, we saw it back in 41. You know, they were using it in a general sense, and then they use it in a specific sense. You've got to go with the flow of what they're saying, whether or not they want you to be thinking about literally that thing that has a unit charge as we describe it, and that certain mass that we know an electron has. I mean, are they talking about that, or are they just talking about a collection of 100 ultimatons with some system of electronic level energy, wrapped around it? So the constitution of varied electronic groups, if you get into particle physics, there's a plethora of different little things we've discovered, especially when you start smashing stuff in particle accelerators, you discover all kinds of different little particles. All those are a collection of 100 ultimatons with different systems of electronic level energy augmenting that base. So there's a varied constitution of electronic groups, and there's groups. There's things we call leptons, and there's things we call mesons, and there's things we call hadrons and baryons, et cetera. All these different ON descriptions. These different groups. That's what they're referring to there. We've built up now from number one is a single ultimaton, two is some sort of intermediate collections of ultimatons, and then three is when you have the full 100. Okay? And then you're thinking about doing something with that collection of 100, like giving it the kind of motion that gives it a charge, or giving it quite a bit of motion that gives it a certain amount of mass. Okay, there's something on the first something on the webinar here.
Yes. Does deity, or let's say Christ, modify energy by its ultimaton level subelectronic, or by its gravity force or space potency?
We'll get to who modifies in the next section, and you'll see what they modify. Now that's a question that comes up in the next section. But remember, it's power beings. Yes, the basic answer, but we'll get to specifics in the next section. There was questions over here. Yeah, that's right.
There's variations of that suffix, but it ends in O-N-S, ons.
Right.
That akin to unit?
Right. So you noticed units, various other units, uh-huh. Right? The O-N suffix now just, is used to indicate a unit of a certain type.
Okay.
Right. All right.
Number four, subatomic matter. Matter existing extensively in the interior of the hot suns.
Okay, that's more shades of what we were just talking about. Remember what's going on inside that star. What's coming into that assemblage are whole atoms, but the more they get processed, the more they get unraveled. It's unraveling those. And so this is describing, by subatomic, they mean you don't have the full atomic system there anymore. It's been unraveled to some degree. And you're saying, well, unraveled in the sense of electrons stripped off? No, more fundamentally, you can see we're about to get to that in the next ones. Here means, this used to be a much bigger atom, but the very nucleus has been unraveled to some degree. If you just looked at it factually, it may be a carbon atom. Okay? And so you say, well, what's subatomic about a carbon atom? It's like, well, it's subatomic because it didn't used to be a carbon atom. It used to be something a lot bigger than that, and it's been unraveled down to something that small. Right? So You know, they'll mention this at the end of this list, that these descriptions aren't all, you know, if you're just plopped an item number 4 in front of you, you wouldn't necessarily know it was item number 4. You might think it was item number 7. You know, but it, you know, because you don't know the history of it. You don't know that it used to be a much more complex system, that it got unraveled down to that. Remember, they mentioned that, you know, basically nothing is left unraveled within a star. Everything is unraveled until finally you get all the way down to the core, you know, and you're unraveling the collections of 100 ultimatons and getting that sub-electronic smaller collections, and all the way down to you have nothing but ultimatons, you know. It's been completely unraveled. All right, so, beginning stages of unraveling when they're talking about subatomic. Yeah. All right.
5, shattered atoms found in the cooling suns and throughout space.
All right. Remember, we've talked about shattered atoms before and how they were different. They were, you needed to understand them as different from ionized matter. Here you see it right juxtaposed, 5 and 6 here. Remember, the difference is, again, what led to that phenomenon being in the state it is. You know, you look at it, it's like, okay, I see a calcium atom that's missing one of its electrons. Yes, that's what you see. But the question is that electron that calcium atom is missing, is it still in the vicinity? Have the two just been separated? Or did you take that electron and unravel it? And so now it's not there. Okay? Now, that's what you mean if it's shattered. Okay? You know, and you could have shattered atoms locked in a, you know, in a solid core of a dying star, or you could have one that's been flung out into space, and you know, have a whole bunch of those shattered atoms flung out in space. If you just look at them, it's like, well, it looks like a calcium ion. Well, it's not technically a calcium ion because the electrons are not with that cloud of, you know, it's actually just shattered calcium atoms, you know, that have been thrown out of a star, and their electrons that aren't with them anymore were evaporated down in the middle of that star. It's not a plasma that's floating out into space. It's just the shattered shattered atoms, you know, that are floating out into space. So either way, whether they're locked in this solid or, you know, thrown off into space, they're not technically ions. See, so, but scientists would call them ions.
So they can't just pick up a random
and say this is a shattered one and this is an ionized one. No.
So the calcium that's been shattered that has no electron nearby, mm-hmm, can't just pick up a random collection of 100 ultimatons because they have to be at the right.
Well, it could click, you know, it could pick up another electron and, you know, and be a full one again. But, you know, if it's in a very rarefied setting, especially a rarefied setting where there really aren't any electrons around, that's not going to be an easy thing to do, to find an electron somewhere that you can latch onto and be a whole calcium atom again.
But I mean, so a collection of 100 ultimatons can't just change to an electron because a calcium atom's around.
Well, there certainly are these possibilities where you have something that is just a collection of 100 ultimatons and it could interact with some phenomenon and get turned into an electron. Yes, that, I mean, or vice versa. I mean, if you start to unravel an electron, the first thing you're going to do is strip the electronic level energy off of it and have just an electronic level base, just that collection of 100 ultimons. That would be step one in unraveling it. Step two is actually starting to, you know, take the 100 apart. But, you know, the first step is, before you get down to the collection of 100, you're just going to have, you know, like if you're thinking about the atomic nucleus, you've got all of this complexity built upon that collection of 100. You're going to unravel all that until you get down to the, you know, the bare collection of 100. You know, that's that subatomic thing they're talking about there, basically. See? Right. So all of this is, is in play, all this complexity. You know, and see, with those units of motion that we call mass or charge, they are units, but they're not, collections of automatons. They're not in this list of matter. You know, they're energy, and it's units of energy. But you don't want to think of, I take a collection of 100 automatons and then I add another automaton and now that has charge, electric charge. That's not how this works. You add energy to it, not particles to it, to give it that charge. Okay. So shattered atoms, like we talked about before. And then now we're finally going to get to a follow-on to what you asked me back when we first talked about shattered atoms, Sydney, with the ionized matter here. A loose end is going to be picked up here.
6, ionized matter. Individual atoms stripped of their outer, chemically active electrons by electrical, thermal, or X-ray activities and by solvents.
Okay, so those... this is just, what we completely, basically understand, the gross phenomenon already, of ionizing matter, stripping off an electron. So, something that you can understand in a very simple billiard ball fashion. And, I've got this atom and I've got this outer valence electron, this chemically active electron, and I just strip it off. Okay, and it's not associated with the rest of the atom anymore. It's, off by itself. Okay, and I could do that, electrically, a neon light, right? Thermally, whatever. X-ray activity, any sort of waves in the force charge could pound upon this and strip off an electron. When they say X-ray activities, they're talking about it being impacted by waves in the force charge. So waves impacting upon this particle. And by solvents. Okay, and that's related to, when you asked me before, when we were talking about shattered atoms, and I was talking about the difference between ionized and shattered, you said, now is ionized anything like radicals, free radicals? And before I get to that, I wanted to go back and remember just exactly what you asked me so I could pick up on it precisely. And so I went back and listened. And a little side note here. I discovered as I was listening, that was when we did the section on calcium. And I discovered that when we first started that section, I was describing how things got started historically with studying calcium in space. And then sodium in space. And I was referring to the spectral lines of calcium and sodium. And I properly talked about what they label those two important in that context spectral lines of calcium. They call them H and K. You may remember me talking about the H and K lines of calcium. And then because they just mentioned sodium in passing also in that section, I was going to mention some of those details of sodium in passing also. And so I was going to mention the very close pair of lines of sodium that they were looking at when they discovered it in space. And I was thinking the sodium D lines, H and K with calcium, and they're called D with sodium. And for some reason, I said K. So, as long as we're picking up loose ends, there's a loose end for you. If you're listening to that old recording, and you're trying to figure out what I'm talking about there, and you go looking for sodium K lines, you won't find that. You're looking for sodium D lines. So, the sodium vapor lights, are emitting in those. They're called the D lines. Yeah. Well, see, that was one where, since none of you were wondering about that, you didn't catch me saying the improper thing there, but try your best, except when I get way off in the weeds like that, and you can't correct me. But, I don't know why I said K. It meant to say D. Okay, meanwhile, back to ionized matter. Now, the thing about ionized matter and radicals, I mean, they're not identical, but there's a similar thing in play in some ways. I mean, if you're reading an article about free radicals, I mean, directly what they're talking about is an atom or a molecule, simple molecule, most likely, that has an unpaired electron. And because it has an unpaired electron, it's very chemically active. It wants to fix that issue. It wants to find a match. It wants to pair up that unpaired electron. Now, the basic way that you think about bonding, like H2O, is you have unpaired electrons. The hydrogen atoms each have, you know, they only have one electron, so obviously they have an unpaired electron. And the oxygen atom has two unpaired electrons. And so the two hydrogens can get together with the oxygen, and now you have two pairs, you know, rather than four unpaired electrons. And that's why it forms that molecule, because it's trying to pair everything up. Now, if you take H2O, you could imagine breaking that H2O in two, where you had an H and an OH. Now, if you just literally kind of pulled it apart as is, you had two electrons that were being shared in one of those bonds between an H and an O, you know, and they're not paired up anymore. So now you have an unpaired electron on that OH, you know, and that unpaired electron again on the H. That OH is a radical. Okay, so it's what you mean. It's one of the very significant ones that they talk about a lot. The hydroxyl radical. This OH, you know, with that unpaired electron sticking out there, very active, you know, and if it touches anything, it's going to chemically, you know, react with it and mess. You know, like if you dumped a bunch of those into your body, it'd be really disastrous because it would just start tearing apart molecules in your body, right? Not a thing you want to do. So, you know, that's fundamentally what they're talking about. Now, the reason that there's a similarity to that radical phenomenon with ionization, another way you could think about pulling that hydrogen, or that water molecule apart into a hydrogen and an OH is to actually take, you know, both of the electrons that are involved in that bond and put them on the OH. So now the OH doesn't have an unpaired electron. It's got a pair. You know, you could ionize that radical. And so now it's an OH negative ion, an anion. And the, you know, the hydrogen would be a plus one cation.
Right,
we had no electrons, so now it's, you know, it's a positive ion. It's a cation. So that's another way. See, notice how, you know, that there's a lot of closeness there. I mean, when you're thinking about, sometimes when you think about bonds, you think about what's being glued together is actually two ions, and you call it an ionic bond. But other times, like with water, you think about what's being glued together as radicals rather than ions, and you call it a covalent bond. But actually, it's all, I mean, you don't literally have two ions that are glued together. It's just the sharing in an ionic compound is kind of lopsided. It's they're like quasi-ions. You know, like in this case, if you imagine, both the electrons were kind of more glued to the OH than really the H, you know, and so it was almost like it was two ions that were glued together because they're opposite charges, and light, you know, opposite charges attract and they glue together. You know, that's the way you think of table salt, sodium chloride, as being positive sodium ions and negative chlorine ions glued together in an ionic compound. But actually, you know, they aren't literally ions. They're you know, it's a, everything is actually being shared, not fully transferred into a complete two separate billiard ball things. And the two billiard balls have this mysterious force called electric, you know, Coulomb force that glues them together. See, it actually isn't ever like that. It's actually all of the space in between is this complex system of, you know, of these electronic level energies being, you know, spread throughout the construct rather than all glued to one side or the other. All right. So when I answered you before, I said, well, yeah, you know, there's, depending on how much you kind of want to push the current paradigm, you know, and think a little bit more in terms of revelatory mode, you know, you begin to rethink this very stark distinction between radicals and ions and you know, because it's all kind of a little bit too billiard ballish, okay? And you know, you might want to blur that a little bit depending upon the context. To understand it better, okay? All right.
So, Chris, since we're in the section of ionized, I know we were talking about matter and the chemical reactions and stuff, but what about ionized radiation? Like, how does that compare and contrast?
Well, ionizing radiation, you know, if they were just referring to the fact that you can have various phenomena that might impact an atom and ionize it. I mean, X-ray is ionizing radiation. You know, if I you know, expose something to X-rays, especially if it's higher energy X-rays, I can pump enough energy into that to ionize the atoms in there. You know, and if it's some sort of an organic structure that needs its integrity, you start unraveling it like that. Okay, and there's going to be problems. You know, and it doesn't have to be waves. It could be a particle could come in and smack it and knock an electron off too, and that would be ionizing, you know, energy. Yeah, so either way, you know, if something has enough energy to overcome the grip that the atom has on that electron, you know, that electron is going to get stripped off, and you'll have ionized matter, and that could have deleterious, you know, health issues associated with it, you know, if what's being ionized is you, right? all right. Okay, but, you know, again, you know, just, you know, if I go out in the depths of, you know, if I go out to the Orion Nebula and I grab this thing out, you know, out of the nebula there and I look at it and I, you know, it's like, I've got an ion. Well, maybe, I mean, you know, is it kind of, did you grab it out of a plasma where the electron that it doesn't have is actually floating around in that cloud too? You know, or is this a shattered atom that you just grabbed there? You couldn't tell by just looking at it. You'd have to follow its history, you know, and see how it, you know, where it came from, whether it's technically shattered or ionized. And so just think about that, that subtle distinction, having some sort of a parallel to the 10 forms of energy. You know, so it's not so much an existential distinction as an experiential distinction. And that's kind of an interesting element of wondering how these list of 10 might match up with those 10 fundamental forms of physical energy. All right, finally you get to number 7.
7, atomic matter, the chemical stage of elemental organization. The component units of molecular or visible matter.
Okay, that's all just, you know, very straightforward, just what we know of is atomic matter. Just maybe in the light of us mentioning radicals, you know, just remember that with that atomic matter, a lot of those atoms have an unpaired electron. I mean, you know, what ones definitively don't have unpaired electrons and aren't chemically active? The noble gases. You know, that's why, you know, we didn't discover them for a long time, because they aren't chemically active. But most things are chemically active. They've got unpaired electrons, and that's, you know, I mean, like, you know, take chlorine. It's got one unpaired electron. It's why it wants to do things like make, you know, hydrochloric acid, say, or it wants to get together in pairs and make a chlorine molecule. You know, why don't you just have single chlorine atoms floating around in a chlorine gas? Why do they pair up in diatomic molecules? Because by themselves, they're radicals. So they pair up so that the molecule is not a radical. And that's why you have a number 8. Okay? It's why you don't just have 7. It's because even when you have a full atom, there's a degree in general of an incompleteness to the phenomenon. Okay? It's not as symmetric as it could be. But you put it into molecules, and you get a definitive symmetric phenomenon. No loose ends, you know, nothing dangling, nothing waiting to be resolved. You sort of have actualized all the potential. You've reached the completeness of, you know, starting with space potency and evolving this energy until finally you've actualized all the potentials of the phenomenon. A chlorine atom still has the potential to do more than just exist. Is that, you know? To get really to a fully satisfied purposing, you have to go to the molecular stage. You know, very few things exist in a pure atomic form. Literally as just one isolated atom. Noble gases do. You know, there is a neon atom. You know, and it doesn't care if there's any other neon atoms, you know, in this local universe. But carbon's not that way. Carbon's going to, you know, if it's just going to be a bunch of carbon atoms, it's going to need some companions, you know, to make a diamond, you know, crystal or a clot of graphite or something, right? It's not self-satisfied. You know, it still has a potential to do something, and so it does something. It seeks out other atoms to complete itself. All right, number 8.
8, the molecular stage of matter. Matter, as it exists on Urantia in a state of relatively stable materialization under ordinary conditions.
See, when it finally gets complete, then it's relatively stable. One of those radicals, like an OH radical, you know, there's nothing relatively stable about its materialization, you know, whatsoever. It instantaneously seeks greater actualization of its potential. It's very aggressive. It has the potential to grab a hold of a lot of things, do a lot of damage. In its effort to seek inner peace, right? So that's what they're like I was just saying, to finally get to something that's, it's like, okay, now I can just be what I am. You know, a water molecule is very content to just be a water molecule ad nauseum. But a hydroxyl radical, no. You know, or an ion, you know, no. The ion is not feeling very symmetric and balanced, you know, in a way that we call electric, you know, it's manifesting an electric charge. you know, in the midst of a lot of neutrality.
Water is called the universal solvent,
isn't it? Right. It's because it's a polar molecule. There is an electric dipole across that molecule. There's one end that's kind of positive-like and one end that's kind of negative-like. And that's why it works as one of those solvents they were just talking about there. You know, you throw table salt in water, you know, and water looks at that, those sodium and chlorine atoms that are almost like ions in their bias of sharing their electrons, and just nudges it over the edge and unravels the sodium chloride into sodium ions and chlorine ions. You know, it takes the two unequally shared electrons and pushes them all to one side and separates the phenomenon apart, you know, so that in solution you have sodium and chlorine ions. So that's the fundamental way a solvent works, is it intervenes in that electric motion phenomenon and pushes it, you know, to one side, biases it, you know, to a state that now, you know, I mean, obviously sodium chloride together is this brick of stuff, and then you turn it into a bunch of loose billiard balls. See, so it's kind of pushing it more to that billiard ball state where there's just this ion and this ion and this ion, you know, and they're all just free. See, again, that sort of free ions, free radicals, you know, do you have something that is, that is out free and, untapped potential to bond, whether it's ionic bonding or covalent bonding, whether it's an ion or a free radical. See, that's the parallel that's in play there. But definitely ionic bonding is that's what they teach you first, because that's the most billiard ball-like picture. And then the next quasi-billiard ball thing is covalent bonding. And then when they go beyond that, it really ceases to be billiard ball-like. The rationalization scheme they give you gets very hand-wavy and quantum mechanical. Okay.
9, radioactive matter. The disorganizing tendency and activity of the heavier elements under conditions of moderate heat and diminished gravity pressure.
Okay. Now, I've mentioned this in passing. Here you see it beginning to be stated more directly. The diminished gravity pressure, okay, obviously if something wants to unravel, I could be putting a lid on it and not letting it unravel. Okay. But fundamentally, radioactive matter, it's unraveling before your eyes. Why? Is it because it's inherently unstable, like current science assumes? So there's just something that's just not content about it, and so it flies apart? Or is it being broken apart? What's holding it together, that undiscovered phenomenon? So if something breaks it apart, something's interfering with that undiscovered phenomenon. Oh, the something that would break it apart then is also undiscovered. No wonder they assume it just magically comes apart. They don't know what holds it together and what is at that same level that breaks it apart. That's subelectronic phenomena. Okay. Bigger atoms are radioactive, fall apart, because the environment is hot. You know, they're going to generalize the word heat, too. You don't just mean simple thermal jiggly heat. We mean activity. The subelectronic domain is active. It's hot. And it's hot enough that it breaks bigger atoms. Moderate heat, right? We're not talking about inside of a star, where it definitely is hot enough to unravel everything, but sitting right in this room, kind of moderately hot. The moderate level of subelectronic activity that's in the environment in this room, if I have a uranium atom in front of me, it's unstable and it falls apart. It gets not broken apart by this activity assailing it. Okay. So again, it's like, wow, we're talking about something that's very phenomenological, an interaction between an atom and its environment. And that's somehow is in parallel with the 10 phases, 10 fundamental phases. You can see a lot of very mysterious things of parallel between experiential and existential. You see, you kind of see what you're starting to get here. You have the 10 existential forms, and there's a parallel of 10 sort of experiential forms parallel to that in some way. Okay, but that's the basics of what's going on there, is that, as I've said, in this environment, it's hot enough where anything bigger than element 83, anything bigger than bismuth, gets broken by the heat of the environment, the activity in the subelectronic domain. That's radioactive matter. Okay, and then number 10. Oh, you got a question?
Yes. What is holding them together?
Like I said, you know, they talk about that later in the paper here, but it's what seems to be magic. If you look at an atom in a billiard ball fashion, it seems that, you know, there's two, you know, like just take the nucleus and an electron. It seems that with nothing in between, the electron and the nucleus somehow want to stay close to each other. And you have to imagine some sort of invisible, mysterious influence force, you know, in between the two that is locking them together. You know, this is our current force models like gravity and whatnot. But actually, you know, it's really the same sort of thing of, you know, you don't immediately wonder what is holding this cup together. It seems logical because there's no gaps in it, so you don't even think of it needing to be held together. It's a continuous thing, and so it just is together innately. Right? Well, what if an atom actually was a more continuous thing? Then you wouldn't so wonder what holds it together. It's just this contiguous fact that just is. That's more like what it is. You know, rather than parts being held together, it's a whole. See, that's the thing. We try to rationalize everything with a father-like model, where everything is parts, and then mystery and magic glues parts together. But nothing is actually like that. Everything is a whole. You know, and you don't ask why a whole stays together. It's a whole, therefore it's together. Okay? That's more fun than what's going on, is recognizing, you know, in the same way we don't ask why, you know, an electron stays together, because we think of it, you know, we think it's a whole, you know, it's not a collection of parts. You know? Yeah, it's the same way. An atom is really fundamentally a whole, not a mystical collection of parts.
So if a family falls apart, it's because they're not relating as a whole. Two individuals.
This distinction is vital, for in a cosmic system, the individual members are not connected to each other except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. So if a family breaks apart, it's because they're lacking the appropriate relationship to the Paradise Trinity through the mother.
Or it's time to get out of that.
Right? That's what that statement's trying to tell you. It's not because they each haven't consecrated themselves as individuations to the Father. And then magic does the rest. They have to consecrate themselves to the, you know, except in relation to the whole, the Paradise Trinity, and through the individuality of the whole, the Mother. That's the only thing the only way for holism to manifest. The Father's the individuality of the parts. The Father can't give you wholeness. He can only give you partness. You know, and he does it in spades. He gives you absolute partness. He hands you this personality that's absolutely not part of any whole. It's absolutely individuated from the whole. It's absolutely distinct. He absolutely partizes you, particularizes you. Right? And then you've got to, you can consecrate yourself to being individuated like that. You can consecrate your will to the perfect will of God the Father, so you don't just diffuse into nothing. But after you consecrate yourself to being individuated, now if you're going to do anything with your existence, you have to consecrate yourself to the whole through the individuality of the whole, because then and only then could there be some sort of a expression besides you, the island universe. Again, it doesn't matter if you're talking about understanding fundamentally the physics of a family system or a collection of automatons. It's all the same physics. Nothing has a holistic expression except in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. The fundamental revelation of the fifth epical revelation. Why is it that we languish in futile yearning despite the fact that we're all very earnestly and definitively consecrating our wills to the perfect will of God the Father, and yet our relationships fall apart, and our families fall apart, and our countries fall apart, and why doesn't anything magically stay whole like I believe the Father does? It's because the Father doesn't do that. You have to consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother if you're going to have any manifestation of being part of a cosmic system rather than being an island universe.
And are you rancher foundation and brotherhood and fellowship?
Right. Will any of those things stay together as wholes with mere consecration of will? No. No, they can't. Nothing can stay together. No civilization can stay holistic. Nothing can stay together. No group of any size can stay together if they aren't cosmic citizens. If they're merely children of God, they will break apart. They have to choose also, in addition, to be cosmic citizens, to have a relationship to the whole. And then the whole will manifest within them and through them. That's the fundamental physics of the cosmos. Personalities or matter. All right. We haven't done 10 yet, have we?
Number 10, collapsed matter. The relatively stationary matter found in the interior of the cold or dead suns. This form of matter is not really stationary. There is still some automatonic, even electronic activity, but these units are in very close proximity and their rates of revolution are greatly diminished.
Okay, so you kind of just get the idea there. You have this very clamped down form of matter. And you notice they are being a little bit more specific than they have been sometimes when they talked about this, the relatively stationary matter found in the interior of the cold or dead suns. Don't expect to go to a dark island of space and have the outside surface be that ultimatonic crystal. There's going to be mushier stuff on the outer surface, especially if it's not gigantic, if it's just star-sized. Obviously, the bigger it gets, the thinner the mushy crust is going to be, to the point where even the surface might be pretty darn crystallized, and because it's under such extreme inwardness clamping. They're just nothing outward is being allowed anymore. you know, even down to the automatons, they're barely allowed to be much of anything except something in a straitjacket. Yeah. Okay.
And as you said earlier, because energy or because force is basically trying to get out, they explode eventually.
Right. Either something, you know, smacks into them and allows that, you know, breaks that grip, or the secondary dissociators step in, and in their presence, you know, they're an unraveling catalyst, and they loosen that, you know, that inward grip. They just apply some outwardness to that region of space, and then the grip isn't strong enough, especially since most of the stuff inside, in and of itself, doesn't want to stay together. It wants to fly apart because it doesn't have any mass or anything. Right? So if you just loosen the inwardness a little bit, you know, negate some of that inwardness, you know, it just by itself just all flies away. All right, and then a final little statement.
The foregoing classification of matter pertains to its organization rather than to the forms of its appearance to created beings. Neither does it take into account the pre-emergent stages of energy, nor the eternal materializations on paradise and in the central universe.
Okay. So just, you know, not even any of that puissant energy stuff or anything, you know, just in between automatons and you know, fully developed matter. And like I told you, they'd mention that, rather than to the forms of its appearance to created beings, like I said, you plop a shattered atom and an ionized one, it's like, there's a difference? No, they're identical. I measured every property, they're the same. Yeah. You know, so again, it's like, well, why, more fundamentally, why do they distinguish? Because they don't see things as just little static objects sitting here or there. They see the whole thing as a dynamic set of circuits, right? You know, that atom that's sitting there isn't just the thing sitting there. It's the whole circuit of evolution that it's in to them, right? You know, and you know, to think of that not just abstractly, as it has a, you know, like you might say in like a relativistic sense, it has a certain world line that it's been going along, you know, a certain location in space and time that it's been going along that's different from that one. You know, this one used to be inside of a star, this one, you know, wasn't, it's, you know, those sorts of things. But to see it more holistically, that, you know, you aren't just what you are right here. The real you is everything that you've ever been and ever will be. You know, transcendent beings, especially the Father, relate to you in your wholeness. You know, the existentialization of your wholeness, you know, in his case, you're only an eternal lighter to the Father. He can't know you in time. So, you know, take that full embodiment of your wholeness, of all that you could ever be in all of an infinite eternity, you know, and that's what he relates to. Can you begin to see yourself like that as well? You know, and if you do, then you'll resonate a little bit more the way they just classified matter here. Not so divorced, not so alone,
shattered,
you know, et cetera. Yeah, yeah. Not so island universe-like. See yourself as a cosmic citizen, i.e. a part of a cosmic system, a gigantic, unimaginably complex system of motions going every way and every direction all the time.
And yet organized.
And yet completely organized, yeah. To see yourself in that gigantic dynamic flow, and that's the truth of you, and the ultimate reality of you, not what you appear, you know, like they say, you know, not the appearance. Don't think of yourself by your appearance alone. You know, you appear to just be a blob of protoplasm groping in the darkness today. Right? That's not the truth of you. All right, let's get into this next section a little bit. You have something too? Okay.
Well, it's section 10.
Number 10 there? Yeah.
Number 10, sorry. So, why do the rates of revolution are they saying that the rates of revolution slow down because they're in such close proximity? And then, so if that's true, why?
In order for them to speed up, they need space, and they don't have it. Well, we'll get to that in a section coming. I mean, it's just there's a correlation between how fast they're evolving and how large spatially the manifestation is. You know, it can't be going fast in a severely limited space. It can only go slow, and so that's what it does. It just goes slow. It's all because there's this external influence. It's not letting it go any faster. And again, it's like, well, I don't understand why there would be a relationship between a speed and an spatial extent. Well, you should, because that speed is a motion, and that motion involves space. There's an element of it. We don't have things in space. All we have is motion. And motion involves space. You can't have more motion without more space.
Exactly opposite to what we right? taught.
It's not like, you know, I could have a little ball here and I could have a top inside of it spinning as fast as I want, couldn't I? You know, that's not the way to think about what's going on here.
So I think automatons and their movement.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they don't move around one another like this, do they?
No, we'll get to that. They don't, no.
When they're talking about the revolution, they're talking about the...
For them, it's an axial revolution, not an orbital revolution, yeah.
And yeah. If it's electronic energy, then that could be particles moving in relationship to one another.
Right, I mean, obviously, the more it gets to be something that's manifesting in kind of a billiard ball fashion, the more it can be described as some sort of an orbital phenomenon, rather than just something that is a motion, but more something that is in motion. Something that is in motion, you know, the current way we think about things. We have things that are in motion, rather than things that are motion. Right.
So you must be able to extrapolate that sort of micro level or relationship between space and motion into why the size of the grand universe, why the Milky Way is as big as it is, why there's so much space between us and our neighbors.
Right. I mean, all those things are related. I mean, the size of the master universe is related to how much motion will exist in the completed master universe. It's like, well, that motion isn't there. How could the size be there? Well, it's not there from your bottom-up point of view, but the full master universe completed is there from a top-down point of view, and that's why it has the size that it does. That's the size of that much motion. Again, little reminders that, you know, if you're a transcendentaler, you look out upon, you know, absonite universes. You don't look out upon finite universes. You're an absonite being. You know, that's why I've pointed out occasionally you'll notice them talk about absonite worlds as if they already existed out in the outer space levels. You know, what's up with that? Well, they don't exist from our finite temporal point of view, but they do from an absonite point of view. I mean, the supreme being, a transcendental being, is standing on something. You know? He's not standing on a finite phenomenon. He's an absonite, you know, being. You know, he has projections down into the finite that we talk about, but you know, literally the supreme being, you know, the being that made Magistan is a transcendental being. And, you know, he doesn't stand on a finite world.
Though the world of outer space are material.
Right. Well, right now, everything, all we can experience is the finite aspects of those things. You know, even no matter how things get completed in the grand universe is settled in light and life in those outer space levels, everything out there will be a finite phenomenon. You know, what's developing right now. But everything will get transformed in the grand universe, you know, settled in light and life, and we transcend the finite. All the stuff that you can't experience now will become experienceable. You know, the absentite all exists. It's just you can't experience it yet, so you think it doesn't exist. You know, it's mind projection fallacy. I can't experience it, therefore it doesn't exist. Well, who do you think you are? Kind of an absolute phenomenon, are you? No. You know, the consummator of universe destiny doesn't relate to an infinite emptiness. He's a co-absolute being. He relates to a cosmos infinite that's all there. Yeah. Yeah. And it doesn't matter that the architects of the master universe can't experience the cosmos infinite. They know it's there nonetheless. Yeah. Because they know that just because they can't experience it doesn't mean it's not there. Everything is there. You're just slowly trying to come into bottom-up relationship with the cosmos infinite. And you experience very little of it right now. But it's all already there. You know, I think we won't even start the next section. Why don't we just, you know, talk this out some more, and then we'll just start the next section from scratch next time. Yeah, so go ahead.
Well, you mentioned earlier about, you know, the whole thing of being, I mean, you're really a part of the whole. You really, you know, whereas it's just with father image, you're part. With mother image and everything else, you're pretty much the whole. Well, and on this world that we live on, because of the backwardness and the you know, the revolution or whatever it's called.
The rebellion.
Rebellion.
And the default.
Rebellion. Star Wars. And because of the rebellion and everything, you know, most people, first of all, they don't even believe in any life out there, so to speak, and the whole concept is very foreign. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that people think about a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
But just think if they did. You know, and I think that, so it's so... Someday, this revelation, you know, is going to catch on to more of a, you know, more in the way that we, you know, the people will be able to say, and then their intelligence will also grow at the same time. And I think when they have that sort of frame of mind or that perspective, it would be a lot easier to, you know, to evolve.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, think about fundamentally why it is that someone has an increasing self-righteousness. You know, that might potentially go all the way to iniquity. Why? What is inherent in us that we could go down that path? How could we ever believe so self-righteously? Now, it's because all we know to begin with is what was initiated by the individuality of the parts. That not only is a part, but the definitively part-making influence has an absolute dimension in it, you know, the personality. And when you go down a self-righteous path because you believe that reality is what you experience, and your initial experience is, I am I. Because, you know, the Father put that in your head, you know. The I am put that in your head. You know, you don't appear to be part of a cosmic system. You appear to be a quite individuated island universe. And especially once you've gotten a little bit biologically older, you can really get it into your head that, I don't need anyone's help. I don't need anyone else. I don't need any. I've dotted every I. I've crossed every T. There's no vicissitude of life that could fundamentally, you know, hurt me. I've got every insurance policy possible. I've got, you know, I've got everything all pinned down. You know, and I'm driven to that because that's how it appears, that I can stand alone. Right. This, you know, at some point, you've got to recognize that you don't actually stand alone. You know, that there isn't one iota of you that is self-sustaining. Not a single particle, not a single quality, nothing.
Not even your will.
You're not a creator being. There is nothing about you that is self-maintaining. You are maintained. You are part of a cosmic system. That's the fifth epical revelation. See, we need that to avoid where we could begin to go now in really extreme self-righteousness, now that we're more spiritual and can actually do something with righteousness, except delusion. We can definitively go down that path of self-righteousness now. We need to know now. It needs to be revealed to us in every way, shape, and form that you do not, you cannot stand alone. That's an illusion of your initial immature, you know, appearances. You're a cosmic citizen. You only have any ongoingness in relation to the whole and through the individuality of the whole. This is the great gift of the fifth epical revelation, to save us from ourselves and to save civilization from being unraveled into little island universe particles. Okay. There's an emergency of losing our by grace relationship to the whole. There's no emergency of us losing our relationship to being a part. I mean, Jesus definitively put that behind us 2,000 years ago. You are very definitively an individuality. Every one of us gets a fragment of infinity now by grace. Hard to trump that in terms of individuation. Okay? And it's not just in truth. Now it's in fact that we're individuated. But now there's the great danger that you could decide, what else do I need? Why do I need you? I have an adjuster. Why do I have to be interested in you and what you're doing? Who cares? I have a fragment of infinity in me. I'm completely self-contained. Matter of fact, the more I reflect on this experience inside me, the more I'm pretty sure I'm a god. Right? And this is where this goes. Right? You know, and the fifth epical revelation is saying, please no. Please no. Don't go down that path. Don't do that. Don't use the other blade of the sword that the Father gave you to destroy yourself. You know, He gave you creativity, but it's not a one-sided sword. It's a two-edged blade. Every measure of creativity has an equal measure of destructivity inherent in it. Don't use the Father's gift to destroy yourself. It's like, well, how do I avoid that? Is it not just innate that the little selfish child is going to just ball himself up into an ever more absolutized ball if he's given more and more relationship to absoluteness? Not if you take delight in cultivating, having a relationship to the whole and the individuality of the whole. It's the only thing that can save you from yourself. And it's the only thing that can save civilization from self-destructing. Right. I mean, you'll never get to the brotherhood of man if we can't even hold on to the beginnings of civilization. You know, the genuine brother, the fullness of the brotherhood of man is the fullness of civilization. It's not the beginning of civilization, it's the end of civilization, you know, potentializing civilization. this,
the actualization of the whole.
Right. I mean, to make the world a holistic phenomenon, the Father doesn't do that. He just potentializes that. I can't have any relationship to the whole or the individuality of the whole if I'm not a person. I have to be made a person by the Father first. He has, you know, he gives me the potential to be part of a harmony. He is the potentiality of harmony. But he's not the actuality of harmony. The mother is the actuality of harmony. Okay? Now, and if we stop reflecting, we have an initial connection to the whole and the individuality of the whole by grace. That initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit, purely by grace. No precursor, no prerequisite, you know, involved. Just given that initial encirclement by grace. But you're also given the potential to destroy that encirclement. And long before you destroy your individual relationship like that, you'll destroy the socialization of that initial encirclement of grace. You know, you'll disrupt civilization. You know, so it begins with civilization unraveling. You know, it could culminate in individuals unraveling. You know, the holistic phenomenon on Gerasim unraveled in very short order when Lucifer went public, and then the individuals involved continued down that path, and several of them individually unraveled. Mm-hmm. Right? But the immediate emergency, you know, is civilization, because it's pretty hard for you to unravel yourself in this short life now that you have all of the gifts of grace post Pentecost. It takes a pretty supreme effort now. I mean, before you could just not make it to getting an adjuster and then you wouldn't survive. But yeah, you've got this. You have a soul by grace now, and you know. And most of us are completely too clueless to actually achieve some sort of a supreme destructivity decision to destroy that soul. I mean, you can't even get close to supremacy. We're so primitive and ignorant to things we think and do. So you're not going to destroy that embryonic soul. That's extremely unlikely. Okay, but the fluffy little delicate socialization of our individual cosmic nature, the beginnings of civilization, that could be destroyed very easily. Yeah. Yeah. We need to reconsecrate ourselves to the whole.
What John Zebedee kept saying,
Well, again, right? I mean, you start by just that motivation. You have the motivation to love one another. But why do many people languish in endless frustration? They've been motivated to love people for years in their life. But they look at their life and it's like, hasn't been working very well though. I've got a lot of people that just desperately hate me. And I keep seeming to, you know, get in my own way. And what's missing here? Okay? What's missing is the other half of the fourth epical revelation. It's not just love. It's love and service. Right? How do you go from the inner life fact, your motivation of love, to loving service? You have to go from the inner life through your associating mechanism out into the outer life. And that's where the problem is. That's why there's all of this, languishing and futile yearning. You yearn to be in loving service, and you have all of this motivation to love, but it's just not working. You can't figure out how to get it translated from the inner life to the outer life. That's because you can't do that with the Father. The Father is purely an inner life thing. He's not in the outer life. The Father can't help you get from the inner to the outer or to work in the outer. He's not God as immanence. He's not out there. The Mother is out here. You know? The only way that you can engage that system and effectively is if you know the rules of the laws of that system. And the laws of the external world, the outer life, are the laws of the Mother and the Trinity. In order to effectively serve, you have to know how to face facts and adjust them to ideals, like the ideal of love one another. That's an ideal, but it's not an idea. An idea is taking that ideal of loving one another and figuring how to effectively translate it into an idea of loving service. How do you relate it to the facts? And if step one is using your ability, your imagination, to say, I'm going to pretend that everyone out there is innately divine and equal, and then I'm going to love them. It's not going to work, because they aren't. None of them are innately divine, and none of them are equal. Everyone is completely different and far from divine. And you know, you can't take this pure divine love motivation and just apply it to something that isn't divine. You got to figure out how to downstep that into something that's very lumpen, very far from divine. How do you do that? How do you make that work? The Mother is the way to understand how a cosmic system works, to be able to synchronize with it, to finally be materially effective. Remember, they tell you as you go up the cosmic levels, as you go inward in the psychic circles, that always manifests as material accomplishment. It's actually, for instance, actually effectively serving. That's a material accomplishment. Right? Love is just an ideal. Can you go from, you know, the mere fruits of the Spirit, that are all single words, to the cosmic fruits of the Spirit, you know, like loving service, you know? The mere,
what have you done for me lately?
One must do something as well as be something. How do you actually do it? You don't just imagine it. You've got to figure out the physics of a cosmic system and synchronize with it.
That's the beauty of life, isn't it? It's like the experiencing of it. Without that, I mean, and we all know, we all fall down, and we get up again, and we fall down, and we get up again. And that's kind of the beauty of it, how you grow in that process. Especially, as you said earlier, if your intention is pushing your spirit inside you, keeps you moving in that direction.
Yeah, I mean, obviously loving service will never happen if you don't first have love.
Okay.
But, right. But, you know, am I just going to be an eyes closed, ears plugged, you know, blob of love? Or am I going to actually do something?
You know, well, I was at the airport a couple days ago to meet my daughter, who's coming in being gone for several years, and where the trains, the people get off the trains from the concourses and come out,
yeah.
There was a gentleman standing there just helping people who, you know, were coming out of the train station,
mm-hmm.
not knowing where they were,
right.
Where they were going. And
helping them with direction.
And he was a unique, somewhat unique individual in that these people were all strangers that he was helping, but they weren't really, he was like a friend,
mm-hmm.
in midst of strangers.
Right. He bridged that gap. He engaged them, you know, in a cosmic, harmonious way.
He really did.
Right.
Yeah,
he knew the laws of a system. Right. Yeah. All right. Let's wrap it up there. But that was a good way to end. I mean,
yeah.
Again, we can get kind of lost in the abstraction of all the automatons and whatnot. But remember, there's only one system. Anything that you could learn about how the physical energy system works, you'll understand how a family works more. There's only one system. It's all the same system. Okay? So you're trying to relate to it in that holistic way. Don't think in specialization, compartmentalization way about anything in the book. Things in the marriage and family papers help you with physics, and things in the physics papers help you with marriage and family. It's all one system. All right, let's take a moment here.